This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Coronaviruses are not rare. Oftentimes, they're not even dangerous. In fact, the family of viruses are sometimes to blame for the common cold. But certain strains of the crown-shaped virus that jump between animals and humans can cause lethal outbreaks. And that's what we saw in 2003 with the SARS outbreak, more recently with MERS. And the most recent addition to the coronavirus family is spreading quickly from its origin in Wuhan, China, and the global community is preparing defenses. The Barrick Laboratory in Chapel Hill plays a key part in developing those antiviral defenses. Ralph Barrick is a professor of epidemiology at the Gilling School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and joins me now. Ralph, welcome to the State of Things.
Hello, Frank. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. No, it's great to have you here. The first person-to-person transmission of the Wuhan coronavirus in the U.S. was confirmed yesterday. How concerned should we be here in North Carolina?
Well, at this time, there's six confirmed cases in the United States. And what people need to be aware of and pay attention to is whether the person-to-person transmission cluster that's beginning and that has begun in the Chicago area, whether that continues or whether it's been quarantined sufficiently early to prevent further spread.
What's the most reliable source, do you think, for updates? If I'm curious, where do I go to look?
The WHO and the CDC both have fairly up-to-date websites, but the news media is also keeping fairly good track of the expanding outbreak.
All right. So let's find out another way to ask the question, how concerned should we be, is to look at the mortality rate. We talked about SARS and we talked about MERS. What do we know about the mortality rate from Wuhan?
So right now, the estimated mortality rate is between 2% and 3%. The other indicator of how serious the infection is the percentage of individuals who have serious disease. Roughly 20% to 30% of the infections result in a serious illness that may require admittance into an ICU.
All right. And how does that compare to the other two coronaviruses that made the headlines, SARS and MERS?
SARS coronavirus almost exclusively caused serious illness. Mild disease was very rare. It resulted in a 10% mortality rate, and a much higher percentage of individuals required treatment in a ICU and perhaps mechanical ventilation. MERS coronavirus has a much higher mortality rate. It's about 36%, and it is somewhat different in that it does occasionally have cause mild infections and even asymptomatic infections.
So by those measures, we would say this is far less dangerous or somewhat less dangerous than the other two.
Well, it's a double-edged sword. So in the case of the SARS outbreak, for example, most everyone who was infected had serious disease. And of those individuals, they didn't really start transmitting virus until 24 to 36 hours after those clinical symptoms emerged. This allowed contact tracing and quarantine to really prevent them to spread the illness to other individuals. In the case of the 2019 strain, mild infections are also common, and there is evidence of asymptomatic infections. It's fairly clear that individuals with mild infections can transmit, resulting in community-wide outbreaks. So although the mortality is lower, the virus has taken advantage of that reduced mortality by having a rheostat, in essence, of a disease illness that can be caused in humans. And this allows for more efficient transmission.
So more people may get the disease because you may be asymptomatic or have mild symptoms and not even know that you've got something more serious.
That's correct. In the case of mild illness, you may think, well, I have flu or I have a common cold or I have one of the contemporary human coronaviruses. I don't really need to go to the hospital, but you will be symptomatic. You'll cough, and you'll have the potential to spread the illness to other individuals. And so that makes the virus more insidious, and is probably why we're having so much trouble especially in China, in terms of clamping down on the disease outbreak.
Well, let's talk about the containment strategies. How do they differ? What are we doing now, and how are they different from other strategies?
In the case of the SARS outbreak, which is a good way to understand public health intervention strategies, in the case of the SARS outbreak, there was an animal reservoir. It was civets and raccoon dogs that people consumed as a delicacy that could transmit to humans. So one of the things the Chinese did were to cull those herds, so there weren't any animals to transmit. The second vulnerability that SARS had is that most of the transmission events occurred in hospitals, and hospitals became epicenters for disease expansion. And so implementation of barrier nursing techniques and masks, N95 masks, and other barrier clothing would prevent transmission to healthcare workers and super spreader events in the hospital. And so that reduced the amount of spread. And then, of course, I just talked about the severe illness allowing for quarantine and contact tracing to limit transmission. Now, in the case of the 2019 virus, hospitals, there are examples of super spreader events in hospitals that one individual infecting 14 healthcare workers. So hospitals are linked to some extent to the expanding outbreak. But what's clear is that community spread is occurring and individuals are spreading the disease in a community setting. So if they're at home with their family, if they go to movie theaters or places where large numbers of individuals congregate, they can spread to those individuals. And that led to the Chinese government locking down 20 cities, closing railways and all travel to try to prevent community-based spread to the rest of the country.
And again, I've heard that to some degree is a double-edged sword. Talk about the effectiveness of that strategy.
Well, it's one of these common sense strategies, right? The idea is that if you lock down a city, you will prevent the virus to spread, you prevent the spread to other cities. Most of the modeling that's been done argues that even if you could prevent people from 99% of the people in a city from leaving the city and going to another location, you would only reduce the increase in the outbreak by about 25%. And it really is just a delay. So it's very difficult to lock down 60 million people. So this is a grand experiment. Part of the problem, of course, is that people in the lockdown areas may not have access to food and other resources that they need to function and survive, and so they also want to get out of an area that is perceived as an epicenter. So the common sense response is, I want to get out of this area and I want to get out of it fast.
All right, well, talk about some of the antivirals at your lab at UNC, what you're developing, and perhaps what's being developed elsewhere.
We've been working exclusively with Gilead and other collaborators around the U.S. who've developed a class of drugs called nucleoside analogs. And these are drugs that are incorporated into the viral nucleic acid while it's trying to replicate, and it blocks virus replication. And so we have identified two that have broad-spectrum activity against all coronaviruses. So not only the contemporary human coronaviruses, of which there are four, these drugs will work against SARS and MERS. They also work against a big group of what are called SARS-related viruses. These are viruses, SARS came from bats, the 2019 virus came from bats. And our lab has isolated a fair number of these bat strains and analyzed them. And some of them have as much variation as the 2019 strain, although they can't replicate in human cells. And we've shown that these drugs work against them. So the idea is that both of these nucleoside analogs should be able to work against the new virus.
Any idea when they might be ready for distribution?
There's an IND, one drug in collaboration with Gilead called remdesivir has been sort of fast-tracked. It can be used in emergency settings with 2019 novel coronavirus infections. The second drug is under review. It will be under review at the FDA around the 3rd of February.
Now, obviously, viruses are famous for their ability to change, hence the reason we get a cold every year. What about antivirals with regard to these coronaviruses? Won't there be something else that we have to worry about?
In terms of resistance, it was very difficult to evolve resistance to either of these drugs in the laboratory setting. Certainly, in an outbreak setting with large numbers of individuals taking drug, and it certainly allows the virus much more opportunity to evolve resistance. But in our hands, it was quite slow. The next class of monoclonals next class of antivirals that will probably be online fairly quickly are human monoclonal antibodies. These will have been isolated from individuals who were infected with the novel coronavirus, the 2019 novel coronavirus, and are actually cloned out of those individuals and then manufactured in high concentrations for use in infected individuals.
Ralph Barrick, professor of epidemiology at the Gilling School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Ralph Barrick, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank. Pleasure to be here.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org.